Welcome to episode 275 of Sports Geek. On this week's episode, I chat with Aussie basketballer Chris Anstey about how his Mavs upset the Last Dance Bulls.
Welcome to Sports Geek, the podcast built for sports digital and sports business professionals.
And now, here's your host, who is a handy point guard who must be defended for three-point shots, Sean Callinan.
Thanks, DJ Joel. Yes, my name is Sean Callinan. I don't know how my three-point shot is going that well, as I discussed in this interview with Chris Anstey. Haven't had a chance to go and shoot a hoop in the current lockdown. But thank you very much for tuning into this podcast. You can find this podcast on all good podcasting platforms. Also, you can find it on our website, sportsgeekhq.com. And you'll also find it in the Sports Geek newsletter, which you can subscribe to by going to sportsgeekhq.com/SGN. As always, you can contact me. You can reach out. I am very contactable. Sean at sportsgeekhq.com or at Sean Callinan or at Sports Geek on most social media platforms. And you can also join me for a live Zoom call. We've been firing up the Zoom calls over the last couple of weeks. They've been a really interesting, great discussion, being joined by some of the podcast guests previously. We've had Todd Kaflisch, Steve Pastorito, Lenny Goh, Casper Heisenberg have all joined on the Zoom, and I've probably forgotten one or two, and my apologies. Stacey McGrainer has also joined. So what I want to do is each week, starting to get the format right, is have a bit of a theme. So last week the theme was looking at media and how it's changing, how it's evolving, both in the DC during COVID and PC post-COVID. So yeah, it was a really good discussion last week on both the calls. The calls are held on Wednesdays, 10 a.m. here in Australia, which fits at 5 p.m. for my friends in the US, in the western part of the US. For PST. And then Thursdays, we have one at 8 o'clock, 8 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time, which is around midday from friends in Europe and early morning for those in the UK. So those Thursday ones at 8 o'clock, I might or may not be drinking a beer to finish off my day, but the conversations still seem to flow. So we'd love to have you on board. Go to sportsgeekhq.com/Zoom calls. Or you can find that on sportsgeekhq.com to register. Register every week so you get the new fresh Zoom link. We don't have any Zoom bombing on the Zoom calls. So this week it's going to be all about digital. What's it going to look like during COVID? What are people doing? What's the landscape going to look like post-COVID? And then next week, May 6-7, we're going to look at the world of sponsorship, how it's being disrupted. What people can do. So I want to get into this episode, but before I do, I just want to talk about the Patreon campaign. You can support everything that we're doing in the sports business space by going to our Patreon campaign, sportsgeekhq.com/Patreon. It helps pay for the costs of this podcast, the editing, all the work that gets done. So you really do appreciate you can support for as little as $4 a month. That supports what we're doing in the podcasting space, the newsletter space, and also now in the Zoom call space. And there is options there if you are a sports, technology, or marketing business that want to reach the Sports Geek audience. You can become a silver or a gold supporter. My guest today is a good friend of mine, Chris Anstey. He is an Australian basketballer, an NBL and Boomer great. Represented Australia on numerous occasions, an NBL MVP, and one of the early Australian players to make a splash in the NBA, being drafted by the Dallas Mavericks. And he was lucky enough in his rookie season to come up against the Last Dance Bulls. So I'm sure everybody who's listening to this podcast is watching The Last Dance. I've been very impressed with the two episodes I've seen so far. Chris shared a story about when his Mavs played the Bulls on his Facebook page. So I thought I'd give him a call, have a bit of a chat about that and about his basketball career and close coaching philosophy. So this is my chat with Australian basketballer Chris Anstey. Very happy to catch up with a good mate of mine, known him for many, many years, Chris Anstey, former basketballer, played in the NBL and also in the NBA, and recently wrote a really great Facebook post that coincided with The Last Dance. So I want to chat about it. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, John, thanks for having me. It's amazing what writing can do, huh? It's been a lot of fun with this spare time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so, I mean, that was the trigger. But as I said, we've known each other for a long while. I think I remember meeting you at was the depot maybe of the 93 Melbourne Tigers championship win when you were about to enter the NBL way back when.
That sounds about right. We was it every Thursday night? We used to go to the depot for a meal with the team, and that was the local. And no, they're always, the hoodlums, of course, and a few of the other people close to the team would tend to join us. But no, it was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. But the thing that triggered, I mean, obviously everyone in the sports world has been watching The Last Dance. The first two episodes were last week. And that was actually your first season in the NBA. You were a rookie there for the Dallas Mavericks in 97-98 under Don Nelson. And you did. You wrote this post. You started to do, like we all are, take up new hobbies, writing some memories, and you've been sharing some of that on your Facebook page in the one time that you faced the Bulls in Dallas. What was it? I mean, you describe it in there, and I'll share the link, but was that the first time you'd faced Michael Jordan and sort of seen him in real life?
Well, I'd seen him early on in the year because we played in Chicago, and I didn't get a minute. That was a game where it was almost the first time that the NBA ever knew of the old Hacker Shack, but we were fouling Dennis Rodman and a teammate of mine, Bubba Wells, fouled out in 2 minutes and 43 seconds. We just kept putting Rodman on the line and
it
was a little bit disconcerting because even in that I couldn't get 2.5 minutes to go and foul Rodman every time. So that wasn't the best of my confidence. But when they came to Dallas, even from early on in the year, I had family and friends who had booked tickets and, I'd booked tickets to get to the game. And
circled it in the calendar to see MJ.
That's it. And I still wasn't sure how many would make the trip because back in 98, it was harder to get to Dallas than what it is now. And it all turned up and, leading into that game, I'd been playing a lot. I was 32 and a bit minutes a game. I looked up the other day and playing pretty well. So expected that this would be my opportunity or my only opportunity to play against Jordan and the Bulls. And when I didn't play a minute in the first half, I was gutted at halftime. And here's me, probably my first memory outside of the preparation was sitting in the locker room at halftime. We're down 8. And this is before social media, of course. And when I thought, no one's going to believe me that I played against Michael Jordan. I need a photo. I need to prove or that I can send home, and I'm thinking, how do I do this? And
were you giving Don Nelson like the daggers in the back of the head and doing all the things to make attention?
It was just this. It was whatever. But you can't put your arm around Michael Jordan during a game. If I got to jump time and sort of point him across to the camera crew, say, Mike, if you wouldn't mind a photo. So
yep.
I'd landed on the resolution that I was going to foul him as hard as I could and as quickly as I could if I got on the court, and assuming it would be garbage time, but not my finest moment or my finest thought. But it turned out that 4 or 5 minutes into that third quarter, I actually got substituted in because Don Nelson wanted a little bit more length to go and send in a trap at Michael Jordan, and I was long and gangly and dumb enough to do whatever he said, and it was great fun. I played the rest of that third quarter, 7.5 minutes in that third quarter, and most of the fourth and most of overtime, and it was incredible.
I mean, and really, it was a comeback. You shared the full game and the highlights, but like the game should have been over, like 10 minutes down 10 with 2 minutes to go. It should have been all she wrote
against anyone. I mean, no matter who we're playing, let alone the 5-time world champion Chicago Bulls. But it was one of those minutes. Yeah, we're down 10, as you said, with 59 seconds to go, and every shot we needed to make, we made. Every miss we needed them to miss, they missed. Steve Kerr, who at the time was a 94% free throw shooter, missed both of his free throws. Jordan missed a free throw. We got a 5-second inbound violation on Scottie Pippen, and Cedric Ceballos ended up hitting a three near enough to the buzzer. They still had a shot to win it in regulation, and Tony Kukoc missed a 9 or 10 footer. And then overtime became this wave of momentum for us, which was just, it just didn't seem feasible that that would happen. But
I really like the part of your story, and you said it in your post, and you see it in the replay where, yeah, you foul Steve Kerr, and Steve Kerr's automatic, like put him in the book. And then he missed the first, and he, you know, gave a little wink to say, oh, I won't miss the second, and goes and misses the second. And you actually see the wink on the replay.
Yeah, you do. AC Green was our most veteran guy on the team, and if you ever get a chance to see the footage, or if anyone gets a chance to see it, as Steve Kerr's lining up to shoot it, AC leaves the block and just wanders right into the middle of the lane before Steve got the ball and starts a pretty long conversation about why he should miss. And, you know, it's funny, over the years I was never a trash talker, but you can get in people's heads. And one of the easiest things I learned was a lot of basketball players don't think, they act on instinct. And AC Green, from memory, you know, he asked Steve Kerr, when you're shooting, Steve, you're one of the best shooters of all time. Do you watch the ball in the air? Do you watch your fingertips? And so Steve Kerr all of a sudden must have been thinking about what he actually looked at. It must have worked. But, you know, AC never swore. He never drank. He never did a lot of things. But he was very eloquent in what he was able to say, and that worked at the time.
I want to see if this works. I've never done an interview via Zoom and showed something. But I have got the quote from Don Nelson near the end of the game.
Takes a look. Anstey had the hot hand all night and makes the jumper.
For the rookie from Australia, and the Mavericks have taken a 4-point advantage in overtime.
Now here's a play in which it's just a gutty play, because Rodman is one of the best offensive rebounders in the game, and you got to face up to these guys. He also is a pretty dirty player, so you know, he's pulling, grabbing here, and Anstey just lets him know he's not going to put up with any of that foolishness. Does it in the right way, in which he doesn't throw the elbow, but he lets him know that, hey, you want to play rough, you know, I can play rough too, with a nice smile on his face. Perfectly done. And he says, hey, mate, you want to play rough? I play rough too, and I'll scar you, I do.
Hot hand all night, only for the in the second half there.
Yeah, I couldn't hear it, but I know exactly what he said. I watched it last week. I certainly didn't have the hot hand in the first half, unless he was watching warm-ups. But that jump shot, you know, put us up four, and I had a dunk a little bit later on in overtime that put us up, I believe, 4 or 5 as well. And it was just incredible. It was right place, right time. By then I'd reverted to habit and instinct, I suppose, and it became another game. And just to be a part of that memory for myself, I suppose, but my teammates, was incredible to do it, but at the same time, incredible not to stuff it up, because I was in a position to win. And the last thing I think anyone wanted to do was be that guy who let a win like that slip.
And then, you know, follow up, and we hear later Don Nelson sort of goes through your little tussle with Dennis Rodman, and, you know, the talking about getting inside people's heads, that was sort of his stock and trade. What was that experience like coming against the Worm?
Well, that was incredibly difficult for someone who never looks to shoot the ball. Just always had to work, and I learned a lot of the craft around how to get teammates open and how to position yourself to rebound away from the ball. But my job was to niggle him, push him, and if anyone's ever got the time to watch the game, you just see us both hitting each other all game long, which probably for me always was one of those guys. Even when I got to the Tigers to end my career, there were times I switched off a little bit and cruised at the start of the game, but the minute someone hit me, I switched on. And, you know, maybe that game was a little bit, you know, for me, of what was to come. But it was great to go against him, but that little tussle for me at some level was, all right, I kind of got to him a little bit because everyone knows his history. They know what he's perceived to be, but I made him bite. And more than anything, that might have been my third rebound for the game. He probably had 19 or 20. I haven't looked at the stats, but that one I got was important.
Yeah. Oh, well, Don Nelson, I mean, unfortunately with this video, you can't hear it, but Don Nelson liked it and liked that you sort of stood up yourself, but he must have one of the worst Australian accents, I think, of all time.
It was really, really bad. And I think Americans have gotten better, but back then when I said I came from Australia, people still thought that was further south in the United States. It was crazy. Yeah, there was a lot of geographical ignorance in Texas. I love them, and they're some incredible people, but they just didn't learn too much outside Texas or the United States.
So that was a highlight, I guess, for that season, because it wasn't the greatest season for the Mavs that year or your rookie year. How was that contrasting with the next year when you got to play with two guys that went on to be, you know, they will be Hall of Famers, Steve Nash and Dirk Nowitzki?
It was different again because that was incredible, but it was so compact because we had the lockout and we ended up playing games, I think, in 80-something days, which was unheard of. But the time I spent with those two during the off-season, which was meant to be the preseason when you weren't allowed to be around the group, was incredible. And I suppose that's when I learned plenty. There's also a story on my Facebook page about Steve. The hardest working basketball player I've ever come across. And people tend to forget that he struggled a lot when he first got to Dallas. His performance was bad, but, you know, he'd be caught out working late nights. And I ran into him one night working on a runner. And, you know, I'd seen him do it and I found out he did night after night after night, and then saw him and he was getting booed by 15,000, 18,000 home fans every night. And never dropped his head, never stopped working. And, you know, he went from being someone that Dallas were really unhappy about trading for to someone that they wish they had have kept and a two-time MVP of the league. So those two guys, for me, not only worked as hard as anyone I've known, but probably remained the same people they did then. I mean, I caught up with Dirk and he took the time to send a singlet to my daughter when he heard that she got injured. And we caught up with him, and my daughter loved meeting him just last year on her college visits to the United States, and he's always been really generous. So for me, those two guys have every right to probably be a little bit standoffish. They've achieved incredible things, and they're just the same people. If you didn't know basketball and walked into a bar, you'd have a beer with these two guys and they'd be normal people, which is a huge compliment.
But also the stuff that you did say about Steve Nash was the amount of work he was putting in on shots that he wasn't putting into the game until he got it right. Like, you know, just the amount of work that he would put in to work on a, you know, an off-foot runner and those kind of things till he got it down and then he started rolling out in the games. People don't realise the amount of work that those guys would put in on their craft.
Yeah, Steve wouldn't even bring something he was working on to team practice, let alone a game, until he drilled it for hours and hours because he thought to try something new at team training was selfish.
Yeah,
that to me resonates still and resonates at work as well. That everyone wants to at work have their professional development during work hours and they want to experiment during training, where he was always, you do that in your own time. Yep. And being at home with your team is to work on team elements of your game. And again, he was the best I've known, and I couldn't tell you how many hours he spent on that runner, like you say, his off-foot shot, things that people hadn't seen. And he made them look a little bit easy by the time he brought them out at training and a game, but people didn't really know how much time he put in on.
Do you think someone like Nash, like in the current accelerated game, like he was sort of the forerunner of it, do you think he would be even better in today's NBA that has more shooting and really guard-driven, even more so than it was then?
Maybe. It's hard to tell. It's an interesting one. I think a player like him who handles it so well and he's so creative, and probably more than anything I'd say about Steve, adapts to his current environment. He was never the same. He just kept evolving, that he'd find a way. And I think Dirk's the three hardest things in basketball to guard are speed, size, and space. And you know, shooting gives you the ability to create space. And Steve's skill in shooting was incredible, and Dirk's was the same. So I think you'd find a way for both of them to be successful, even as they slowed down a little bit.
And over your career, so you spent some time in Chicago and then spent some time as a professional basketballer around the world, playing in Russia and then coming back to Australia. What is the life like in, you know, moving, going from place to place, adapting to, you know, adapting to a country you've probably never been to, like Russia? What was it like in the life of a professional basketballer?
Yeah, the thing is with this coronavirus that resonates with me is that this is people's new normal. It's just amazing what you get used to. And I think my basketball career to some extent was that, where I always heard people say, I could never live in A, or I could never do this. And you could. It's just a matter of getting used to it. And for me, that's what the travel was getting used to the environment in Texas, the climate in Chicago, Russia as a whole, even Spain and some of the places I traveled. You know, even with Australian teams on those extended tours, you're in Asia or in China for a long time. You just get used to living in a hotel and in an airport for weeks and weeks on end, and it becomes normal. I've always been fascinated as to what people can adapt to if they're willing to try. And that was, you know, I'll never forget coming back to the NBL after 3 years in Russia, and I was playing for the Tigers, and we had a practice game in Millicent, down near Mount Gambier, near the South Australian border, against the 36th. And we stayed in what everyone thought was a crappy roadside motor inn, and it was the best hotel I'd stayed in 3 years. And I was just singing its praises, and a few of the boys were complaining. And we sat down at dinner. I told a few stories. I was just so grateful for that. A reasonably comfortable bed and a heater was, you know, my perspective certainly changed.
Definitely. And then, so you've since made the move to coaching, and what are some of the experiences or some of the coaches that you've pulled some of your philosophy from?
Everyone, players, and that's kind of why I started writing. I think like Gorgian was still the best coach I ever had, and some of the lessons I learned from him, I've carried with me through my life, whether it's around the basketball court or not. But yeah, I think you get the opportunity to pick and choose from players, from coaches, from people you meet on the journey, and your philosophy evolves. And I've been coaching for 10 years now, and I've done senior men, I've done junior boys, junior girls, and I've just sort of started doing senior women because it was something I'd never done, and it was a completely different challenge to coach grown women. So I'm still evolving. I'll be a different coach in 2 years to what I am now. But there's, you know, if there's one thing that I know, it's that sport's all about, and I think probably work as well, it translates to corporate. It's about empowering people and helping guide them to figure out how they can be successful and finding what's right for them, not what's right for the coach or the boss. And that's something, you know, as a player, I was proud of. I was able to figure out how good I could be, and I love finding ideas to try to help players that I coach be as good as they can be, and hopefully it fits.
Do you think that's part of the coaching ecosystem or philosophy has evolved a bit, where it's, you know, very much empowering the player and the care for the player and the connectedness of the playing group? You know, if you look 20 years ago, it was, you know, the coach delivering their message, it was their way or the highway. And now we're seeing across both basketball, you know, Steve Kerr, it's all about the joy of playing and having joy and that kind of thing. And we're seeing the same in the AFL with Damien Hardwick and Nathan Buckley, you know, putting their arms around the player. Is that something that is part of your closing philosophy?
I think it existed. I just think it wasn't as common. And the really successful ones, I think you'll hear Greg Popovich and Phil Jackson speak of joy. And when I look back at Brian Gorgian back in 1995, you know, we were going to his house for dinner. We spent time with his family. He'd visit us. It was different back then, but the really good ones, I don't think you can teach people a personality. And I think the really, really good coaches are good people who care about their play over their coaching careers. And if you can have that and you've got a genuine care for helping people, then you'll do whatever it takes. It doesn't just happen around a basketball environment. It happens in the hours of the day, and I don't think you can really help your players unless you know more about what's going on in their lives than what happens around that basketball court. So for me, that was Gorgian. He's the best I've had. I think more people have picked it up.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you've still got to be able to be that alpha voice when it's required. And you know, you sit in leadership talks all the time where you talk about three different types of leaders, you know, the authoritarian, the democratic, and the laissez-faire. You've got to be able to be all.
Yeah.
You can't coach people the same. You've got to coach every person in your team a little bit differently.
And so, as we sort of said before, we're in the lockdown. You're obviously working with players. What's your advice for people who are basketballers, young basketballers trying to hone their skills, maybe not having access to a hoop? Yep. What are there some instructions you're giving your players?
Don't use it as an excuse. There are going to be plenty of people who come out of this time, you know, saying it was too hard and they weren't able to do, I couldn't. You're still able to find something. So, you know, adapt, but it's not about skill all the time. I think if I hadn't have found a weight room when I weighed 87 kilos, I never would have been that good. And I think, you know, so many young players, especially in basketball and especially in Australia, spend so much time playing for so many teams that they don't invest anything into their body and they don't invest anything into their understanding of the game by watching other people. I think it's this incredible opportunity to invest in their body, to strengthen their legs, their core, so that they can run faster and jump higher. I think that will create better players as much as what all of the three-ball dribbling. I mean, I've never yep. played in a basketball that's had three balls on the court.
Yeah,
I've never played in a game of basketball that's got a tennis ball, and I understand dexterity and perception and all those kinds of things, but they're gap fillers. I think lifting weights properly, learning to understand how your body moves, becoming more agile, those sort of things, people will get so much more benefit out of than hours and hours of ball handling that I'm seeing online.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when you look at the, you know, the very top of the NBA, you know, best players, you know, Kareem, LeBron, Michael Jordan, they all did that extra stuff in strength and body that were way ahead of their time then to prolong their careers. So
I'm pretty good at maths. I used to do that. And on average, if you're not a point guard, you've got the ball in your hands less than 4% of any particular game, and 96% of the time you don't have the ball in your hands.
Yep.
But we spend 96% of our development with the ball. It doesn't make sense. So we've got to invest in understanding how we play without the ball and, the, you know, investing into the physicality to be able to get to the spots we need to get to without the ball.
Yeah, very good. Before we wrap up, I did want to talk about a mate of yours with the Magic. As a Tigers fan, I did enjoy bagging him a lot from the stands and having the banter, but your mate Parky's going through a tough time.
Yeah, he was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer last year, and mate, he's been battling like crazy. He's been through 4 bouts of chemo. He's been through 6 weeks of daily radiation, a whole bunch of things. And yeah, he was given 12 to 14 months to live in December. And it seems like he's been able to extend that a little bit, but you know, he's still battling and hoping to find a way to battle in a remission. And you know, the basketball community's circled around him. And look, if anyone listens to this and they want to go and look it up, if you look up what WDZY on Facebook, and there's a donation page. If anyone has it in their heart to donate a couple of dollars or forego a coffee next week or whatever it might be, I know how much it's cost him. We've achieved the goal that they set, but it doesn't even impact what he's out of pocket. It's expensive to get sick. So Parky's a champion. He's battling like crazy. He's one of my best mates, and we're all doing everything we can to help him. So whatever it is, he's a superstar.
No, definitely. Like I said, lots of fond memories of those Tigers Magic days, and as much fun it was when he missed,
Sorry to interrupt. I hate doing it, but one of the best calls I've had this last couple of weeks is from Ray Gordon.
Yep.
And as you'd be aware, and people who listen to this might be aware, Ray Gordon and Andrew Parkinson absolutely hated each other.
Yep.
Ray wants to do a reenactment of some of the fights they had to raise funds for Parky. And it's amazing what happens when you leave basketball behind and you all go your way and life gets in the way. And, I'm close with Ray, I'm close with Parky. And it's sort of one of those things where everyone, whether you think you love Parky or not, they've all gone out of their way to support him. And we'll end up playing a game as soon as we can. And the hope is we get the 96-97 Tigers to play against the 96-97 Magic, you know, with a few other players in there as well that might play AFL. And if we can do that, we think that'd be pretty special as well.
That would be pretty special. That that might get the hoodlums out of retirement, mate. We'll come down and give you all some stick. Well, if you are doing an auction, I think I might actually have a Chris Anstey rookie Melbourne Tigers singlet that I might have in the...
Wow, there's not many going around.
Not many of those, yeah. That's in the original, the old school Tigers singlet. So I might actually look it up and see if we can donate if you're going to run some sort of auction. All support. Check out Parky Army. We will put all the links in the show notes for anyone who wants to donate. Cool. As like I said, the basketball world puts their arms around him. I want to finish with the closing five. Do you remember the first sports event you ever attended?
The first memorable one was the Australian Open at Kooyong, and I got John McEnroe's autograph. He was the first autograph I ever had in my little yellow autograph book.
Because you were a tennis player before a basketballer, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. I loved it. I could walk around, and I do remember walking around Kooyong all day long, sitting on back courts, watching all the players I grew up watching. Was incredible.
And was it just did we have the player identification at that point? Was it just a point where you're just like, hey, mate, you're too tall, go to basketball?
No one. I'd never even hit me till after I was 17 years old. This must have been back when I was 13 or 14. I was wandering around.
You would have been to a few sports events in your time. Do you have a favourite food memory or a go-to food?
Favourite food memory? At a sports event, I'll eat it. See, I still like going to the tennis now. And again, it's back to tennis and sitting in the beer gardens and catching up with friends and watching on the big screen. So whatever they're serving with the beer will do me.
Yeah, whatever the beer sponsor is, the tennis, yeah. Yeah, I go to the tennis every year and I never see the tennis.
I'm still old school. I sit in the back. I like the first 4 days where you still get some decent singles and doubles matches on those backcourts. You can just wander in and have games, and that's me.
Terrific. What's the first app you open in the morning?
Oh, you know what? It's probably podcasts. I listen to them when I go to sleep. So I'll either close it, or if I wait. See, I normally wake up at 3 or 4 in the morning and chuck something on to go back to sleep. But no, I'll go through my socials and just check messages and that type of thing. Probably socials.
You've mentioned podcasts. What are the podcasts that you do listen to?
I listen to the NBA ones. I don't mind The Ringer. They tend to do a pretty good job. Don't have any go-tos. I like mixing it up, but
one I said you should check out is
you have to tell me.
Yeah, is the Steve Kerr and Pete Carroll, effectively, because they're on a break. They're effectively doing a podcast talking about their coaching philosophies because they've got the time. And I think they've just released a second episode today on the Ringer channel. So I think it's called Flying Coach. Interesting. They're not talking X's and O's of wide receivers and point guards. They're really just talking what are the big philosophies and how they go about, the coaching business. And they're two of the best.
But they sure are. I'll definitely listen to that.
Who should podcast listeners follow that you follow, that you consume or read, or check out?
It's not a podcast, but I still love reading all of Paul Shirley's stuff. I play with him in Russia. He's written for ESPN in the past. He's written a couple of books. Paul Shirley is incredible. He's just so eloquent. And he wrote a book called Can I Keep My Jersey? And it was the most probably real look at what the NBA really is for people who don't eat, sleep, breathe it.
Okay.
A really, really good book for the basketball fans out there. But I think you go with the times a little bit. You come across people you like, you come across people you follow. But for me, it's never the one person that changes. I like changing my mind.
Yes, definitely. Paul Shirley. Oh, we'll look it up. Lastly, what social media platforms, your MVP, what's your go-to?
Right now it's Facebook, just because I've been able to post these long-form stories. And you know, probably the reason I did it was probably the reason I started coaching was I'd learned from so many incredible people who aren't able to, you know, coach everyone, and I wanted to share some of the lessons. And it's the best for me to put those long-form stories on. And the response has been incredible. I've been really, well, surprised and a little bit humbled by the interest in them. And I'll continue to write them, and I'll continue to share them and all the others. You know, Instagram, my 18-year-old daughter, I can't get off. She's, you know, the young kids tend to love Instagram, and Twitter is where I get my news from.
We're not going to see you doing a dance routine on TikTok with your daughters anytime soon.
You will never. If you see me on TikTok, call me up and actually come around over and punch me in the face.
Okay, that's as ringing endorsement of TikTok I've ever heard. So I will share those links. Most of them are Chris Hansey 13 is your number. They're most of your social channels. Chris, thanks for coming on the podcast. I look forward to catching up with you for a beer down the track and maybe at that game for Parky. And we'll share the links for the Parky Army there as well.
Thanks for having me, Sean. Great to chat.
We'd love your support on our Patreon campaign. Go to sportsgeekhq.com/Patreon.
Thanks again to Chris Anstey. All the links that Chris is talking about, especially those to support Andrew Parkinson, former Magic player that's going through a really tough time. I didn't get to talk about it then, but obviously we were big rivals. Melbourne Tigers was my team, and as leader of the Tigers hoodlums, as Chris was talking about there, we actually we bought a box underneath the goals at a Magic game under a fake company name, because we knew they wouldn't let us sit in those seats if we said who we were. So we booked that box under Vandalay Industries, and I do remember Andrew Parkinson being at the line. At the free throw line with us, full of a few beers, and yelling at him from underneath the hoop to get him to miss a free throw. He missed one, and I remember Warwick Giddy turning to us, sort of telling us to wind it up a bit more. He made the second one. Parky was a great competitor, and we wish him all the best. I will dig out that Chris Anstey rookie singlet and see if we can donate it to an online auction or whatever. And I do hope post-COVID we do have a charity match and bring some of those old basketballers out to play and raise some money for Parky. But the links for that are in the show notes, sportsgeekhq.com/275. Last episode, I introduced a new segment, One Slide, 2 Minutes. And this one comes from... I was using it for a while, but it was actually... I think this... I used this slide. I pulled it from... a presentation I did with the guys at the SBS. SBS is a broadcaster here before the World Cup, and sort of talking to them a little bit about where digital fits and what they could do. And this slide was titled "How Marketing Has Shifted." So again, the links will be, the picture of this will be in the show notes, but it pretty much describes the was and now. And I'm assuming that James, being so good, has already got the ticking clock on. I've only got 2 minutes to do this. And the was that there was two parts. It was creative and channels. And so if we're looking back in the Don Draper era of ad agency land, it was all about the creative. It was all about the big story and the big TVC. And so much of the effort was put into the creative. And the channels were just the things you put them on because, again, they were limited. It was TV, it was radio, it was print. There was very limited channels. Now we've seen an explosion in channels. We've got multiple digital channels with different formats. So we've got Facebook and Instagram Stories, and we've got TikTok, and we've got Twitter, and we've got Pinterest. We've got YouTube. And we've got different lengths of video, all of those kind of things. So the creative has got squashed because knowledge and understanding of the channels themselves is taking up a really big chunk of. I guess, marketing resources and marketing brain bandwidth. Then the other piece is all the tools that you have to use to be able to navigate all of those channels, whether they're third-party tools that plug in to allow the posting, whether they're tools to be able to do the analytics and those kind of things. So the marketer and the digital marketer in particular has to be across all three of those facets. It can't just leverage, well, we're going to just do a really great creative and it's going to fit on all platforms, which is what previously happened. And that's the disruption, I think, that's happening across marketing overall and advertising overall. So I think, yeah, that's only got more complicated and more complex because, you know, the marketing technology landscape keeps changing. The chief MarTech infographic that I keep using now at 8,000 different tools. Like, there's so many tools in that space. So as a digital marketer in these times, you've really got to know your channels and how to present on those different channels, which again is very much the distribution piece for what we're doing in digital to dollars. But understanding of the tools around it and how to access those tools, how to best leverage those tools. And so in some instances, in its simplest form, it's things like understanding the different ways to publish on the different platforms, what you should you be using, that kind of thing, and the advertising product that sits behind it. I believe that's a really valuable tool for a lot of the channels. That's the nuance, that's the difference that marketing has shifted. It's moved away. There's still a massive need for creative, but also creative with the knowledge of the tools and how the channels work, it's entwined now. So that's it. One slide, 2 minutes. There's the buzzer. Thank you very much, James. So that's the new slide. Oh, that's one slide, 2 minutes. I've got to get my segment names right. So I hope you enjoyed that. The link to that slide is in the show notes, sportsgeekhq/275. The other segment was Do This Today. Again, we haven't gone and got new fresh stings yet, but Do This Today. This is one tactic that you can implement today that will improve your life. Now, everybody, and I mean everybody, is currently having Zoom calls. You might even be coming to the Sports Biz Zoom calls, which I hope you do. But now everybody is doing it. And for someone like myself who have used Zoom and GoToMeeting before that for the last 10, 11 years now, it's quite strange because until 4 weeks ago, I rarely turned on the webcam. Most of the time we were just talking and I would share a screen and would effectively work through things. It's normally how I'd work, or I'd be presenting something, but rarely having the camera on. But now it's normalized it. So now we are seeing people's faces. People are playing around with the backgrounds, those kind of things. But the thing I think you can do on your next Zoom call that people aren't leveraging enough is the chat box. So what I've been doing and what I've been playing around with in recent Zoom calls is sort of using Zoom and treating Zoom a little bit like Twitch. So in Twitch, when you're engaging and you're playing a game and you're talking to your fans or talking to people who are watching, you will put a call out to say, oh, do you agree with that? Put a one in chat or put a yes in chat. And so the people who are watching, it gives them something to do, keeps them engaged, keeps them leaning in. So whether you're trying to entertain or facilitate a discussion like I might be doing on a Sports Biz Zoom call, or just having a regular meeting, the tendency or the issue you don't want to have is people switching off, leaning back, not listening, not being engaged. And using the chat box is very effective in that way. So whether it's what do people think on this, rather than get everyone to put up their hand and those kind of things or yell out, you can drive that conversation into the chat and have this secondary piece. And then I think the second one, and I'm trying to be more mindful of this as someone who's running a meeting or running a Zoom call, I'm naturally going to talk and fill as much air as possible because I'm a podcaster and that's my voice. That's what I do. But there are people that don't do that naturally. So if you're a quiet person that wants to join in the conversation, that isn't someone that will click the raise hand button or put their physical hand up so they're noticed, Use the chat box to have that say or make that point. And so the moderator or the facilitator hopefully sees that and might pull you in. Or if you don't want to be spoken to, they can ring your point and bring it to the general table, or you will have this secondary chat. So I think there's a lot that can be done in the chat box for a Zoom call. So next time you're on a Zoom call, you know, drop a link in the chat. Say hello in the chat. Drop an intro in the chat. the things that you can do. Like I said last week, if you've got a an idea for a segment or something you'd like me to tackle in the podcast, please let me know. Send me an email, sean@sportsgeekhq.com, or hit me up on the socials. And as always, we've made things really easy. We've tried to simplify things at sportsgeekhq.com. If you do want to get in touch with us, you can do so at sportsgeekhq.com. If you're interested in digital to dollars, fast-tracking that, especially around sponsorship and digital, which will be coming up in our sports biz Zoom calls, you can click that link and click that button and sort out a time. If you're a business, if you're a sports business to business or a technology or a marketing business that want to reach the Sports Geek audience, I'd really like to talk to you about the Sports Geek Amplify series that I'm developing that can help sports find a way to the other side post-COVID. Please reach out. I'd love for you to get involved. And then the other thing is, if you are someone who has been displaced or stood down or lost their job due to COVID, I'm here to help. I'm taking registrations for sports business rock stars. Please go and check them out. Connect with them on LinkedIn. And yeah, they're pretty much people putting their hand up saying, hey, I want to work. So if you want to register and be on that list, you can do so at sportsgeekhq.com. As always, I would love to see your faces and talk to you on the next Zoom call. Simply go to sportsgeekhq.com/Zoom calls. That's it from me for this episode. Thanks again to Chris Anstey for his chat and sharing his insights on the episode of The Last Dance, and he's facing the Chicago Bulls. It'll be really interesting to see if that Mavs game gets featured in a future episode. Until next episode, my name is Sean Callanan, and you've been listening to Sports Geek.
Join Sports Geek Nation, access to exclusive Slack and Facebook groups with regular Q&A sessions with Sean Callanan. Go to sportsgeeknation.com to join. Got a question for Sean? Send it in for our Sports Geek Q&A series. Go to sportsgeekhq.com/questions.
Go to sportsgeekhq.com for more sports digital marketing resources.